Welcome back to the Music and Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is J.R. Peters.
What up, what up?
Here at the Music and Movie Club, we're a group of friends who select three movies, more or less on a theme every month, and each week we write a review of the said three movies on our website, musicandmovie.club, and then once those are all finished, we get together to chat about them. This last month, we picked the theme of 90s adventures, mainly because I wanted to watch The Mummy. That was one of our picks, along with The Rocketeer and Congo. So a few throwbacks here. We're going to start with The Rocketeer, directed by Joe Johnston, released in 1990. This is an adaptation of a comic book, like an obscure comic book from, I don't know when, it doesn't really matter. I think the 70s or 80s. You would think it would be like Superman era, but not quite. Set in the 30s. A bumpkin pilot finds a jetpack. That's the movie. Initial thoughts on The Rocketeer, JR?
This movie's terrible.
Wow.
Absolutely terrible. Nothing about it is good, except for you get to watch the movie and be like, I feel like I know who that person is. And then you look it up, and then you're like, oh yeah, that's... what's her name from The Office who's singing in that scene and whatever. But like, other than that, I was bored. I'm just gonna, it's a D+.
Had you seen this before?
No. Right. Of the Neither three, I had only seen The Mummy.
Oh, okay. This'll be fun. I had not seen Rocketeer either, although I certainly remember the marketing from when I was 6 or 7 years old. In its time of release, I don't know exactly what fast food restaurant had a tie-in with it, but it was one of them. If not McDonald's, it was Burger King. This is a Disney movie, so heavy marketing campaign, more or less a total failure. Property never heard from again. But I thought it was fun for the era. I like the throwback setting. Like this is all in the wake of Indiana Jones and The Mummy especially is going to be heavily influenced by those movies. But there's some of that in The Rocketeer too, both in like the technology of it, like there's blimps and the aforementioned jetpack and the helmet and fighting Nazis towards the end and all that. It's not all the way there by any means. It's a fun PG movie from a specific time period of filmmaking. Inoffensive, I thought. Like a C+ is what I gave it. I liked it well enough. I mentioned the style. We don't get much of this like contained adventure story anymore. The first thing that pops into my head from recently is like Jungle Cruise from a year or two ago, but that's based on a ride. There's probably gonna be more of those. It stars The Rock, and The Rock doesn't do shit if he can't make sequels off of them. So it's not that if this was a hit, Disney wouldn't have gladly made more movies of this type, because of course they would have. But just this like contained adventure. Yeah, I appreciate that part of it. All the tropes of this genre, of this style of storytelling, this lantern-jawed, salt-of-the-earth protagonist and a sexy dame. And he's got his wisecracking sidekick repairman, and they're fighting against a guy in a tuxedo who thinks he's better than them. All right, I mean, you know, classic story.
Yeah, except it was just boring. Like, from the beginning to the end, I felt bored. And I don't know, you know, like, I don't know what I can say, like, oh, I wanted it to do this and this. It was like, maybe just this story is boring to me.
Mm.
Like, there's no way of making this story that's happening. Like you said, it's just like a dude that finds a thing and he just becomes a hero and gets the girl. Like, obviously, that's like a... every man story and has been used a billion times and whatever. But like, I think maybe when you're doing it, this is not actiony enough for me, I think, is maybe what the problem is. is this is clearly supposed to be an action movie too. Like you said, adventure, action, adventure, whatever you want to say. And the action is lackluster, and the story is not good enough for it to be lacking in the action part. Because it's like, if you're going to make an action movie and the action is missing, the story's got to be cool too. It'd be like, for instance, if there wasn't a bunch of fighting in The Matrix, I'm still in because the story is good, in my opinion. In The Matrix, it's like this idea is the idea of The Matrix is captivating, in my opinion. And so when you don't have the action in there for this action movie, the story has to be there. And this is just like, I'm just following people from set to set, is what it felt like. Just everything about it felt not truly connected enough and boring. And just, it never dipped into a crazy low either, though. But that's what happens when you don't take any chances doing anything. You're just making a middle-of-the-road-ass movie.
Yeah. I definitely hear that. Like, and some of it is just, like, the low wow factor involved in, like, the central premise. It is a guy who finds a jetpack. It's okay, but that's all it does. It allows him to fly around.
Right.
But yeah, that'll only get you so far. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. what are planes like in this period? They're one guy flying around. So yeah, there's a limit to, like, the gift that he's able to bestow upon himself. Like, right. Okay, he can get from A to B pretty fast, but he's still just a guy. Yeah. He needs to be.
It's not like he's like a badass outside of the jetpack either.
Mm-hmm. Like, this doesn't help that, like, of the first six or seven characters on the cast list, the lead, Billy Campbell, is kind of nothing. Like a bag of meat. Like, compared to, like, Jennifer Connelly, Alan Arkin, Timothy Dalton, yep. Paul Sorvino. He's just not, or John Polito. He's just not an interesting guy. He's cast for his, like, all-American looks. And yeah. he's a boring character. And is given the task of carrying a lot of this movie. And it just doesn't really, based on, like, his subsequent career, he doesn't really, you know, have that in him. I don't know this guy from really anybody. You mentioned the Nazis. I think that's a fun twist, I think. I accept that. I thought that was fine.
I mean, it's the given twist when you know that it's 1938, though.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, like, even weirder, because it's like, we're not even in the war at this point. You know what I mean?
Well, sure. And, like, I think that's where I get some appreciation for it, because, like, you know, there was some sympathy for Nazis, some amount of sympathy for Nazis in the U.S. between, like, German-American leagues and the Bund. And, like, I don't really know that much about this period just beyond, you know, a handful of names, handful of, like, proper names and organizations. But there's definitely a movie in that where there's Nazi infiltration of the government. Like, it's always Soviet or communist infiltration of the government when it comes to these kind of movies. And people don't, it's, like, too hateful, I think, for like, the average American audience to consider, like, the Nazis would be able to find support in Depression era America. But of course they could. Of course they could. That was the source of, like, The Plot Against America, a miniseries from David Simon a few years ago, which was an adaptation of a book from shortly after this period.
I'm not saying that that's not, like, a plausible thing. It's just, for it to be, like, such a big part of the ending seemed a little bit too much, right? Like, you get the FBI in, and then they're like, now it's Nazis. Like, we've got the FBI was doing stuff, we got the gangsters, and you know what else? We're gonna throw in Nazis. The bad guy loves him some Nazis. We got this big goon, we're throwing in a giant Hindenburg. Like, how you know, how I don't know how to, you know, I'm like missing the words here, but it's like that just seemed like too much for this movie. Like this movie is, everything is middling about this movie. Every decision they've made going into this, every decision for the rest of the movie is very middling decisions. And then they're like, we're going big. Like, we're throwing in a Nazi invasion. You know what I mean? Like, it just seems weird and out of place. They're like, we've got, the only way these Nazis are going to be stopped is this Rocketeer dude who keeps getting his shit kicked by everyone he fights. He's not winning any fights. Yeah. But he's stopping these Nazis. You know what I mean? Like, these dudes are like, a lot of them are training and shit and whatever for war and whatever. And this guy's just like, I just happen to have a rocket. And so I just won.
Yeah, that probably is not light. That is like holding him back in some ways, like when he's not flying with it.
Yeah.
But yeah. I will say the winner of this movie for me is definitely Timothy Dalton as the villain, like doing a very credible impersonation of Errol Flynn, a movie star from this period of time who like starred in Adventures of Robin Hood and lots of other stuff. The scene we get of him on a movie set is very much a kind of movie that Errol Flynn would have been in. And funnily enough, Errol Flynn did have some accusations, if not proof, of Nazi sympathies. So they did a little bit of homework, and Timothy Dalton is really putting his back into this role.
I would agree with that. For sure the best part of the movie. Him and Alan Arkin.
Yes.
He gets to say shit and just have fun. And then Paul Sorvino is pretty good as the...
Yeah, you gotta have this... It's clear what the movie's the going for. They, like, want people cheering for Paul Sorvino in the audience when he's like, I may be a mobster, but I'm not a traitor or whatever he says. I'm not a Nazi. And then they turn on Timothy Dalton. Hooray.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. And I, like, this was the first movie I started of the three. And I was like, holy shit, man. If this is the, like, the action adventure movies of the 90s, that's a bad decade.
It had its ups and downs.
The best, like, thing. Coming out of the 80s with some good shit, and then you're like, here's the Rocketeer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely think there's something to that. Like, this is an 80s genre, and then the equivalent would be like now for superhero movies, where like this trend has exhausted itself, and we're turning a corner into like just studio churned out. And I like this movie, but like studio churned out pap that is nowhere near, that is impersonating stuff in everyone's recent memory that did a much better job.
Yeah. And you also got to think, like, this movie came out the same year as arguably the best sequel ever made, like, right before it. But I just looked it up. The release date for The Rocketeer is June 21st, 1991. And then 2 weeks later, on June 3rd, 1991, Terminator 2 Judgment Day dropped.
Yeah. Probably got
like nobody's trying to go see this movie, right?
Yeah, like it came and went.
It's not only is it like not great, so you don't even get word of mouth stuff coming, but trailers are being played for Terminator 2 at the same time as this, and that's got, you know, that's already got the fucking history of Terminator behind it and everything. So it's just crazy to think.
Sorry,
I was just saying, it's just crazy to think that these two action movies dropped like that close, and we're talking about this one instead of Terminator 2.
That one's just a straight action movie.
Yeah,
I was going for the adventure part of it. Okay. I think like not that I don't it like it's a hard distinction to make, but like the period aspect of it, I think is a big part of it. I would call Indiana Jones like adventure movies just because they go so many places. But then I wouldn't call James Bond movies adventure movies. So yeah, genres, whatever. The last thing to say about The Rocketeer is that Joe Johnston directed this, and he's had middling success. All these directors have had middling success at best in their careers of these other two movies that we're going to talk about, and Joe Johnston as well. He went on to direct Captain America: The First Avenger, which is a much better version of this movie. I think a big chunk of that is a better script and a much more capable lead in Chris Evans, who is kind of writing the same. Like, Joe Johnston is kind of steering the same character in that movie, like a good-hearted all-American guy. And Chris Evans is just miles more charismatic than Billy Campbell is.
Yeah, Billy Campbell, he's based off of this, he seems like a person you wouldn't even just want to be in a room with. Like, you know...
I mean, yeah, it's not just the question of the actor. Like, the movie doesn't give him a lot.
Yeah.
That's...
He just, as this character, the Rocketeer, because do they even give this dude a name?
Like the character's name?
Yeah.
I'm sure they do, but, like, who can remember?
Yeah. It's just like, you get this dude, and he just seems like one of the people that if you were stuck in a room, you'd just be like, I'm just going to go ahead and leave.
Anyways, yeah. My drink is, I need a new drink. And meanwhile, your drink is like, water's full.
Yeah. Yep. You're like, I'm going to go check on what's going on over there. You just walk out of the house.
Our next movie is worth spending a little more time with. It's The Mummy, 1999, directed by Stephen Sommers. Classic story. Egyptian adventurers wake up a long dead mummy, and it terrorizes them. JR, Mummy?
I did not finish this, but this one's fun. I've seen it before.
Yeah.
Multiple times. And I just specifically remember this. I very much remember this movie. Outside of the first bit being a little bit longer than it needs to be. It's a fun movie. You're just like in it. You're in for the ride. This one's like actual action-y too. Shit's happening. And this movie also feels the difference between this Congo and the Rocketeers. It seems like everyone in this movie is like making a good movie. Like, think we're making a good movie versus the other two. I'd say this is like a B, probably.
Yeah, that's where I am. I really appreciate this movie. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of different things it's trying to do, and I think it does all of them pretty well. A couple of star-making performances, and for its leads, some pretty good effects, all things considered. Allowances for the time period, like Phantom Menace is coming out this year, and like those, you know, were terrible, and as far as computer graphics are concerned. You give it some space, and you give it some, you do it some favors and allow it, you know, its time period, and you let some things slide. Just good stuff all around. And we mentioned how much of a riff it is on Indiana Jones. There's like a horror aspect and a comedy aspect and an action aspect. I don't know when you first saw this, JR, but I can imagine like a tender-hearted like 11-year-old or a 10-year-old just being absolutely freaked out by it, which is an absolute asset. Like, I saw
the Guardians scarab of the Galaxy. Under the skin.
Sorry,
I said the scarab crawling under the skin. Yeah. That shit was in my mind. Like, this is probably the third time I've seen this, right? And I probably saw it when I was 10, and then probably saw it when I was 22, and then now, and 10 to 22, that shit, it was in my mind. That was like in my mind at all times was a fucking bug under your skin and still alive crawling around. They got me.
Just any cockroach you see crawling around, you're like,
yeah,
I need to put my shoes on.
Yes. Yeah. I don't fuck with bugs, and I'm sure this is outside of bees, you know. But I'm sure this is one of the reasons, I'm sure.
I mean, like, I saw Guardians of the Galaxy 3 today, and some of the buzz about that was Don't Take Your Kids. That's a PG-13 movie. This is a PG-13 movie. What are people talking about? Like, that movie is the Guardians of the Galaxy. Guardians of the Galaxy 3 is the bar for PG-13 has been lowered as far as like what you can show in a PG-13 movie has been lowered so dramatically by Disney and Marvel. Like, if they, by their standards, this would be like a hard R. Like, the way that bodies get like drained of all their blood or whatever, or like are immediately desiccated. And you mentioned the scarabs, the sand acid burns, and like the brutality of the prologue.
Yeah.
It adds a level to this movie. Again, not unlike The Rocketeer, just because it's different. We don't get this kind of, you have to go to like a PG-13 horror movie to like approach this level of intensity on a PG-13 movie. And that's a missing piece of the current cinematic landscape.
This is good though. This is not only like people were talking about this movie even before Brendan Fraser, you know, like came back, you know, because they tried to reboot this with that 20 with the Tom Cruise one.
Yeah, haven't seen that one.
The Dark. It's not good.
I believe you.
It's not good, but like that came out and people were like when that came out, people around watching these movies were like, yo, The Mummy's dope. Like what are we doing here? You know, like why are we
remaking this? Why is this so difficult?
Yeah, like this one in 1999 got made and it's dope and still fun to watch now. And I probably watched The Mummy around then, I'd say. So, and if you want to see, there's like no horror in that 2017 movie, and that might be one of the things.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a lot of, I haven't seen this movie in, what is that, 7 years now, almost 6 years? So there might be a little horror, but like, nothing that happened in that movie stuck with me. But like I said, it's been 20 years since this movie came out, and there are multiple things that have been in my head that happened in the, like, the dude, literally the scarab crawling under, I remember them fucking burying that guy with, like, throwing, like, 100 scarabs in there with him.
Mm-hmm.
There were 100,000 scarabs or whatever. I remember that shit. And, like, I can only tell you a couple of things about the 2017 film. And like the one thing about the 2017 film, the only reason I even watched it is because the person that plays the mummy is a really dope character in The Kingsman, and that was like, oh, maybe she'll be cool.
Yeah, the blade, is she the Bladefoot person?
She's Bladefoot girl.
Sophia, yeah. Something, maybe Boutella, maybe
Boutella. Yep.
Okay.
Sophia Boutella, and so. There was nothing about the trailer that even had me like, oh, I should watch this movie. I was just like, yo, that person was dope in this other movie. I'll go see it. And then was just entirely disappointed. And there was nothing good about it. I mean, it killed a whole universe. There were supposed to be like 9 movies made.
And yeah.
The movie was so bad. They were just like, you know what? Fuck it. We don't need this.
That movie's legacy is like the pre-production footage of Tom Cruise in like a plane crash, but there's no other sound around him. Nothing is really happening. He's just doing the scream that he does in the movie. It's very funny.
I'll have to look that up.
But back to the 1999 Mummy. Star-making performances for Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz in the leads. George of the Jungle was like a regular grade school movie. Like that would get wheeled in on the cart on field days or teacher whatever days, teacher off days. So I was aware of Brendan Fraser at this period of time, and like he had some success, but in like Airheads and other like dumb guy Keanu Reeves type movies from the early to mid 90s. But this movie is hugely successful. Conceivably one of like the top grossing movies of that year. Again, this was when Phantom Menace came out, so that was surely the number one movie of that year. So like this is like a height of his career moment. I think this is where a lot of good feelings towards Brendan Fraser come from, the success of this movie and like his star power as this like screwball icon. And then Rachel Weisz as the librarian love interest who knows everything about Egyptology. She's, you know, she has her moments too. She'll turn in the best work of her career many times over in other movies, specifically like I love her work with Yorgos Lanthimos and like The Lobster and The Favorite. She is just incredible. Have you seen the Amazon series she's in, Dead Ringers?
I have not. Is it good?
I haven't either. I'm deeply skeptical of it because it's a David Cronenberg movie that I really like, and I didn't think the trailer looked very good, but it got good reviews, and I just need to get over my Cronenberg love and give her a shot. But she plays like twin gynecologists, and I'm sure it gets weird because, again, it's adapted from a David Cronenberg movie. It better get weird, otherwise what are we doing here? Dead Ringers. But yeah, anyways, she's one of my favorite actors in her age group, and like this doesn't this is her like in a mass market movie, and it doesn't diminish my love for her career. I really like this is a movie that takes place in like mid-century. I don't remember exactly when, like 20s, 30s. So like as appropriate for movies from that time period, they have a very nice screwball dynamic. It's like love at first sight, and they hate each other and then like each other and et cetera, et cetera. But I think the movie does a really good job balancing their characters where he's not just a big dumb idiot and she's not like a broken nail weak kind of thing. And like they have this, I mean, it might be the best thing Stephen Sommers, another deeply average director, ever did. But it could happen in any movie from this time period or any movie period. Where they're just like she's packing a suitcase and he's unpacking at the same time. It's all in one shot. It's very like rapid fire, speedy dialogue straight out of the 40s. Like Katharine Hepburn could have been in that scene just like that. And maybe she was, and he was paying homage to it. I don't know. But just the fact that that is in here along with the scarabs and all the other shit and like the like double revolvers action. And there's just a fantastic balance of these kind of genres in The Mummy. You mentioned the scarab scene, crawling in the guy. The guy it crawls into is one of several, I think, really strong secondary characters in this movie. I don't have that actor's name in front of me, but the guy who plays the warden, I think that's, you know, like 1,000%. Every second he's on the screen, he makes the most of it. The actor is a comedian. I just find that guy hilarious. He made me laugh consistently. It's a shame that he leaves the movie when he does. I feel like he could have laughed. He's like the first to die. I feel like he could have been like the sixth or seventh to die. Keep that guy in your movie for longer. And Benny, who plays or John, I can't remember the actor's name. He's a
Kevin Connor. Villain.
Yes. Also a character who's a lot of fun. The necklaces, pulling out the necklaces of the various religions and trying to scare off the mummy as it's approaching him. Great. It's a great idea. It tells you everything you need to know about this guy.
Do I believe in anything? Not really, but we'll see what works.
Speaking of the mummy himself, the better version of this movie, from like a critical standpoint, is the one that I think has more sympathy for the bad guy, for the antagonist. The prologue sets him up as a fairly sentimental figure who is like into the lover of the Pharaoh. Pharaoh's a king, so fuck that guy. And he and all of his people get these horrific deaths. Like I paused it in the wide torture chamber scene, and there's some crazy shit happening in the background of that scene.
Yeah, they're like pulling out entrails of people.
Yeah, while they're alive.
Yeah.
And the guys that are doing that are the descendants of Oded Fehr, another great secondary character. So some part of the viewer is like, should be rooting for Imhotep and his buddies. But the movie just completely loses track of that once he comes back to life and then they make him a fairly straightforward villain. Like
he's just, I'm going to kill everyone now.
Yeah. So that's that's arguably better for like the wide release appeal of the movie, like to make a very straightforward good guy, bad guy movie in the present. But if you were going in blind and you're watching that prologue, you would think, wow, this guy was in like a love match with this woman. They both clearly are into each other a whole bunch. And he was absolutely done dirty. The guy was buried alive with like thousands of scarabs. Give him a break. And the actor playing Imhotep, Arnold Vosloo, the movie like accentuates his detachable jaw, but the guy just has a huge mouth, I feel like, already. And he's like capable of really opening up his, like dropping his jaw as much as possible. Just a good look. He's a very memorable villain for another guy who doesn't really have much of a career after this movie.
He's like super memorable though.
Yeah. Absolutely. Intimidating. He's having fun with it.
If at any point in the last 20 years you would have shown me this guy's picture, I'd have been like, that's the dude. Like, I know who that is. But then you go look and it's like, he's in Darkman and Darkman 2, or Darkman 2 and Darkman 3 are his next, like, highest billing. He's, like, technically in Blood Diamond, but I don't even remember him in that.
I don't remember him in anything else other than this. Yeah. Which is a shame, because he's otherwise, he cuts a figure in this movie. And it doesn't help either that the movie does him dirty in the end. I've said does him dirty like 3 times. Stephen Sommers' like inherent mediocrity cannot help but emerge in like the final climax of the movie, where there's various other mummies like stalking around this tomb, and Imhotep's resurrected lover is like swiping around with a knife, and there's just a lot happening. Like, these kind of movies have this trope of where, like, all right, how do we, and Guardians of the Galaxy 3 just kind of did this too today, where, all right, we have a very powerful villain who can kind of do anything, and how are they gonna, there's no actual way for our cast to defeat him unless the villain just stands around and watches other people do stuff because he's overconfident. And that's very much the case here. The guy could very easily stomp these people. Like, in the second movie, the deeply silly, pretty terrible second movie, like, they give Rick and Evelyn magical powers to some extent. They're just people against this god. He shouldn't be difficult for him to take them out. But yeah, like, the geography of that final piece, that final set piece, is trash. And that's all Stephen Sommers just not being a very good director. In his heart, he did really good for most of this movie, and then he ran out of energy by the end. Anything else in The Mummy?
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. That's what I'd say. This is like the definition you think of when you're doing action adventures. You want to have fun during the movie.
Yeah, classic summer movie.
Yeah, and like this is a fun movie. Like I said at the beginning, my intro, where I was saying that it may be a bit too long. I would still agree with that. Like 2 hours and 10 minutes or whatever this is, maybe a little long for this movie, because the intro to like getting the movie starts to like the mummy doing shit. Like, really doing shit is, like, an hour. And, like, maybe that's too much time there for that. Cut out 15, 20 minutes somehow. But it's still fun. It's still, like, a good, solid movie to just put on and enjoy your time watching.
All right, our final movie is 1995's Congo, adapted from a smash hit novel by Michael Crichton. King of the 80s and 90s paperback airport novel. Congo is about a communications company who needs diamonds to power lasers, and they do and they don't recruit they recruit like a primatologist who has taught his gorilla
But they don't recruit him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty loose, the connection.
He just needs,
they just like happen entirely, to be in the same place together.
Yeah, he's like, I'm going to this place. And then the person that's paying for Tim Curry is like, you know what? I can't afford the money or the gas. And so she's like, yeah, I'll pay for your gas.
Before you got there.
Yeah.
It's a combined trip to the jungles of Zaire to find Amy's home, Amy the gorilla, and the lost city of Zinj, which is where King Solomon kept his diamond mines, thousands of miles south from Israel, but whatever, here nor there. Congo, what do you think?
This movie fucking sucks. There's nothing good about this movie, and actually there is something good. Tim Curry is awesome.
He's
over the top in this movie. He knows, like, Tim Curry knows it's not going to be a good movie. Ernie Hudson doing his little thing as like he's like talking super proper and whatever. Ridiculous. I love that. The rest of the movie, I'm like, what are we doing here? Like showing Alice being like sad that the other monkeys don't, or Amy or whatever the hell this gorilla's name is, like kind of being sad because the other monkeys don't like communicate with her, how she knows how to communicate. I'm like, nobody gives a shit about this. Why are we why are we showing all these scenes of Amy? I just need Amy to sign language shit, like run away. And then that's it. Like, that really does it. Like, the gorilla could have died like 4 minutes into the movie and I would have been fine.
Choked on a cigarette or like swallowed a cigarette accidentally and just choked on it.
Get shit faced and tries to skydive out of the plane after they give her the margarita or whatever the fuck they gave her on the plane. Forgets the parachute. Dies and they land and they just gotta do shit. It makes no sense. Like, nothing about this makes any sense to me. And it can't, this can't be any kind of faithful adaptation to this book, Congo. I haven't read it, so I don't know.
All of the basic plot elements are there. I have read this book, but it's been 25 years, maybe. I did read several Michael Crichton books when I was in middle school / early high school. Just like generalized. I was reading a lot of novels like popular novels like Tom Clancy and John Grisham around this period of time. And Crichton's were probably my least favorite just because his were extremely dense. Like, there are pages of just like DNA sequences in Jurassic Park. And that's okay. Like, the guy did his homework, but as far as like reading, it's not the most propulsive way to take in a book. Like the historical nonfiction books that I would read for like my biology major didn't have that kind of like deep, I know what I'm talking about, like essentially literary bragging in them. So congratulations, Michael Crichton, you know the genetic code, way to go. Those books are, they were fine. I enjoyed explaining to my cousins, my younger cousins, like the really grisly deaths in Jurassic Park, the book, that are like spelled out bit by bit, like how slimy are these intestines and how do they shine in the moonlight, all that stuff. That was fun for me. Congo, I really don't remember much of at all. The movie itself, however, like this is a prime sleepover movie. I feel like me and a buddy went to a video store and we got this. Not feel like this happened. We got this and Dumb and Dumber. And that was a solid night. That was solid sleepover night, a pizza and two mid-90s PG-13 movies. Okay. So I have warm feelings towards Congo generally because of that. Is it a good movie? No, it's not. It's not. It's a for all intents and purposes, this is a deeply silly movie. A lot of that silliness is rooted in the ending, which is just wacky. For a movie about killer apes, you don't get a good look at one until there's like 15 to 20 minutes left in the movie. Some of that is they look bad by any metric. Whether the puppetry is bad or the CGI is bad, I don't know exactly how they made these apes. Like, Amy is obviously like some kind of cybernetic puppet, whatever. Who knows?
I just assumed all of these were people in shit. I thought all of the monkeys were people. Monkey things.
They look too bad to be puppets or to be like outfits.
Yeah, I thought they were outfits, and I was like, this is also horrendous.
Yeah.
That was my thought throughout a lot of seeing these. I was like, how are these costumes this bad?
Yeah. I mean, you get a good sense, I guess, of how, like, vicious they are and how mean they are. They're, like, chucking heads and eyeballs at people. So, like, all right, there's some nice little personality traits for the bad gorillas or Amy. And then you get, by the time Laura Linney is, like, slicing hands off of them with a laser powered by a diamond, the movie's over in more ways than one. And then by the end, they're, like swan diving into lava pits or lava pools. The ending is just wacky.
It's literally got 9 minutes left when she shoots the laser.
Sure. Yeah. And they're just.
They're like, we got to finish
the laser. The movie, too. The diamonds are useless because of their, like, composition. But it does make them useful as superconductors for communications lasers. Like, okay, fine, whatever. I can buy that. That all sounds fine. But you can't have. In a movie, like a mass market movie like this, you can't have diamond lasers and not use them to slice up something, like some kind of living material that's coming at you and wants to pound your face into the ground.
Yeah, so, it's not like this. The problem with this diamond laser is like, give me some diamond laser beforehand.
Yes. Yeah. And like Laura Linney, who is one of like the most heavily awarded actresses of her generation, hasn't won an Oscar, but like so many Emmys and so many Golden Globes, et cetera, et cetera. Like to put a diamond powered laser in her hand and watch her just take these apes apart. Hilarious. What was anybody thinking?
Yeah, it's like. You're like, you mention a laser, 20 minutes into the film. Nothing happens with the laser. You use it twice in the film. And you're like, you mention a high-powered laser, you gotta be shooting that motherfucker off every 15 minutes in this movie. There's also no action in this movie, except for 35 seconds.
See, I like the journey part of this movie. I like that it's hard to get to a secluded place in Africa. That all sounds fine. Especially like in this part of Africa. I don't have any problem with that. I like that seemingly the entire environment is trying to stop you from getting to this place. The hippo attacks, the jungle and all that shit.
I agree with that sentiment, but I don't know if I agree with that sentiment for this movie. I don't think it seemed that hard for them to get there. It just seemed very boring for them to get there, which would be two different things.
They jump out of like several planes and have to dodge several missiles. That's pretty fun.
Okay. I'm thinking more of like, once they get in Africa, they're just like walking around.
Yeah, that's fair. There's different. This movie, I think, goes very quickly wrong in the beginning by casting. Got Billy Campbell on the brain. What's the fucking guy that plays Ash in the Evil Dead movies? God damn it.
Oh, shit. That's a good question. I don't know.
Second.
If you wouldn't have said Billy Campbell.
I think
Bruce Campbell.
Bruce Campbell. All right, yeah. Yep. I think this movie goes wrong by casting Bruce Campbell as like the guy that everybody is concerned about in the first few scenes. Bruce Campbell is good at being a hammy action star, but he's not good at being like a real person. And I just never, even in those movies, like I don't give a shit what happens to this guy. Like how gory are the demon kills? That's basically what I care about in a movie that Bruce Campbell is in. And the same is true here. Like they're going after this guy of all people. I don't know, kind of leave him in the jungle. Like this is Laura Linney's whole motivation is to find him. Whereas like the company she works for wants the diamonds. Whatever. But as far as like other casting goes, you mentioned Ernie Hudson. You mentioned Tim Curry. Delroy Lindo has a fantastic scene in this movie with the "please stop eating my sesame cake" iconic line. And I don't know the guy's full name, but Adewale something. He was out of BC in Oz, and he shows up and he was in Lost too. Not that I ever watched that. He's just a very memorable presence. He brings a lot of joy to whatever he's doing, even if it's something awful, like it often was in Lost. That guy, I just think of him always having fun, no matter what he's doing on screen, and he's having fun as like a memorable Porter in this movie. The accents, like those three guys, Adewale is not doing an accent other than his own, but those three guys know exactly what kind of movie they're in. As opposed to Laura Linney and J.T. Walsh playing Amy's handler, who are just kind of playing it straight and boring. No one would ever call Tim Curry boring.
One of my favorite things, I don't know, was it Adewale guy when he was like, "What's your name?" And the dude, he was like, you know. He said his name was like Bob or something. Claude. Mm-hmm. It wasn't him. It was some other, yeah, another
different
Porter.
Different Porter, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And he was like, Claude. And he's like, oh man, that's a strange name coming from what? Where are you from? And he was like, Mombasa. Have you ever been to Mombasa? And he's like, no. And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? What'd you know then? I was like, that's fucking so good. Like, he's just like, shut the fuck up. Like, why are we making small talk right now? Shut the fuck up.
A fun little aside between two deep castless characters written by John Patrick Shanley, who would later go on to write and direct Doubt. So we've got people with weird careers in these three movies. The guy that wrote Congo also wrote Doubt.
I don't even know what that is.
Doubt, Meryl Streep, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, Viola Davis, nope. Nuns, priests. Nothing?
Got nothing.
Okay, yeah. It's a proper awards bait movie that also happens to be like extremely well written and fantastically acted, and that's like an A-level movie compared to Congo, which is not that. We got to talk about Amy the Gorilla. Just everything she does makes me laugh. Like, just who thought this was a good idea? I love her substance abuse. I love, like, the terrible choice to, like, give her this, like, little girl's voice in her recording pack. I feel
my
like they
name's
could've
Amy.
They could have gone much further with the substance abuse, like Tim Curry's got like a little pinky nail for cocaine, and maybe she like gets into it and just goes fucking berserk. Like, that'd be fun. So you're not, Congo isn't thinking hard enough about how to have the most fun with this terrible premise. How sexually active are she and Peter, do you think? Like, not okay. Zero.
Okay.
It's not
Get
zero.
Get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here. I am not participating anymore.
I'm going to say hand stuff at a minimum. She was probably super into it. What's he going to do? Like, fight off a gorilla, like a horny gorilla? Like, no, he's not. He's just going to have to submit because she can rip his head off.
Fucking
don't lie, JR. You were thinking it.
No, I was thinking.
Come on.
You're over there thinking, you're like, man, she probably gives a crazy.
It's in the movie.
Hand job.
It's in the movie.
And
they
have
weird chemistry.
I'm watching it and I'm like, what the fuck is happening? We're in two different worlds. You're over here in white people world. And you're like, what nasty shit can I do to this animal?
Yeah, they're fucking.
And I'm over here in black people world. I'm like, why is this fucking monkey in this movie? Why is anybody in this movie? Why is this movie being made?
The scope of white people shit extends to human animal relationships in mid 90s action movies.
Yeah.
It's in the movie. I'm not crazy.
I think you're crazy.
Ooh.
I'll rewatch it tonight. I'll let you know.
Oh, but, gosh. So generous. Thank you.
Yeah. I'll gladly put waste another hour and 40 of my life today.
Anything else on Congo? Last word, JR.
No. This is just a deeply bad movie.
Yeah.
Every decision they made in this movie is bad.
Another director who went on to do not very much. Like, this is the version of superhero movies from, like, a lot of these superhero movies are directed by people that had, like, modest success on the indie circuit, and then they get roped into these huge productions, and Disney just does their work for them, and they can't parlay it into anything else.
And what else has this guy made?
Frank Marshall was the director. Let's just double check.
Okay. I pulled it up. He has made nothing.
Like Alive is a movie with a good reputation about like the Uruguay plane crash in the Andes Mountains, and they had to stay alive wherever they could. But yes, like he shifts into producing, and he like produced some pretty good stuff. But yeah, as far as a director.
He directed that movie with Paul Walker and the dogs. Jesus.
Would that be
God. Eight below.
In 11 year, coming out of directing retirement after 11 years after Congo. No dogs. He got the bug again. He couldn't be stopped. So a fun trio of movies of varying quality. None truly great, although The Mummy is a lot of fun. And I'm going to visit my nephews in a week. And I'm bringing The Mummy. I'm going to start getting them into horror. So in a few years, I can take Hereditary up there and just freak them the fuck out. That'll be fun. Our next trio, in honor of the movie Air arriving on Amazon Prime, we're doing Ben Affleck movies. We're going to be watching the aforementioned Air and Gone Baby Gone and The Town. Talk about Affleck as an actor and as a director and as a probably his tabloid history will get in there. And, you know, those are all pretty, pretty decent movies.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff
I have not seen. What are the three?
Air, Gone Baby Gone, and The Town.
Yeah, I haven't seen Air yet. So.
Okay. Yeah, on Amazon Prime. And the other two are on HBO Max, which by the time this episode comes out, will just be Max in what is truly the greatest marketing decision of all time. I'm furious about this. I'm furious about it.
This is insane. HBO, that's like That's got to be one up of there. The most
respected brands.
Yeah.
In film and TV.
No, not even in film and TV. That's just got to be one of the most respected brands. Like a top 50, top 25 respected brand. Like, you know what you're getting with these people constantly. Like, they're not just going to be giving you shit. And it doesn't matter if you look across shoes, clothing, film, TV, fucking whatever. Like, if you say HBO to someone, they're like, oh, yeah, okay. You're like, hey, this is on HBO. They're like, yeah, okay, cool. I'll watch that shit.
The thing that I'm recommending to you, if all I tell you is it's on HBO,
yeah,
you have a sense of what to expect.
Yep.
And we're trading it in for the fucking Property Brothers.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen these, like, advertisement videos for this new service. And it's, like, home of The Sopranos, Game of Thrones, Succession, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Property Brothers, Long Island Psychic.
Fucking Christ.
Like, what? Who thought this was a good idea? Who? How dare you compare any of these things to each other? I am infuriated by it. But anyways, you can catch Gone Baby Gone in the Town on fucking Max, unless they do what they've been doing under this poisonous new leadership and just vanish these properties from their service, never to be heard from again. State of the Culture is doing fantastic. We love all this, all these new consolidations. Everybody's fucking killing it out there. Anyways, you can read our last three reviews and so many more reviews at our website, MunichMovies.club. You can like us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club, Twitter at Munich Movie Cult, and Instagram at Munich Movie Club. Thank you for joining me tonight, JR.
Hey, no problem. No problem.
Yeah, glad you had such a good time with these movies. Have a good night.